12. Cross training as an alternative to running more. The primary benefit of training by the 80-20 rule is better fitness. You will get fitter from the same amount of running if you keep the intensity low roughly 80% of the time. A secondary benefit of obeying the 80-20 rule is that it enables runners to train more. If you take advantage of this opportunity, you will experience additional improvement. Training more doesn't necessarily mean running more. The problem with running more is that increased running volume brings with it increased injury risk. The high-impact nature of running makes it rather hard on the body compared to other non-impact aerobic activities. Cyclists and swimmers suffer overuse injuries too, but not nearly as often as runners do. Consider this. A 1998 study conducted by researchers at England's Staffordshire University found that among triathletes, who of course do a mix of swimming, cycling, and running, more than 60% of all injuries suffered over a 5-year period were running-related. Swimming and cycling together accounted for the other 40%. Some runners are very durable and can run as much as they like without getting injured. If you're one of these runners, you can go ahead and train more by running more. If you're like many other runners, however, who tend to break down when they take chances on mileage, take heart. You can work around this limitation by supplementing your running with cycling or another form of non-impact aerobic exercise. Studies have shown that runners who cross-train more are indeed less likely to get injured. Research also suggests that adding cross-training to a running program boosts performance almost as much as additional running does. In 1998, Mick Flynn and colleagues at Purdue University added either 3 extra runs or 3 stationary bike workouts to the training programs of 20 runners for a period of 6 weeks. All of the runners completed a 5K time trial before this period of modified training and again afterward. Both the running-only group and the cross-training group improved their times by an average of 2.5%. Although fitness gained through cycling and similar activities clearly transfers well to running, cross-training is not a perfect substitute for running. If it were, you could maximize your running performance without running at all. One benefit of running that cycling and other alternatives can't match is improvement in running skill. As we heard in Chapter 6, triathletes who train as much as runners do are just as fit but exhibit less relaxed, smooth ease because they don't get as much practice with the running stride. Nevertheless, the effects of cross-training on running performance are significant enough that even some professional runners do it in large amounts. For example, Adriana Nelson-Perti, a Romanian-born American runner, spends a lot of time on an outdoor elliptical bike, i.e. an elliptical trainer on wheels or a seatless bicycle, which helped her win the 2013 USA Half Marathon Championships with a superb time of 1 hour, 11 minutes, 19 seconds. World-class runners like Perti have more time and more incentive to train than other runners do. If you're like most recreational runners, there's only so much time you're willing to put into chasing PRs. But chances are, it's not really a lack of willingness that's holding you back from training at least a bit more than you do now. It's more likely you just don't feel able to do more. Either you lack the energy, or you fear getting injured, or both. Following the 80-20 rule will solve the energy problem. Runners who switch from the typical 50-50 intensity ratio to an 80-20 balance invariably discover they can easily handle a few extra miles of running. Incorporating cross-training into your regimen will solve the problem of injury risk. Only you can decide how much time you are comfortable devoting to exercise. As a coach, I want you to be the best runner you can be, so I encourage you to train no less than the maximum amount you are willing to do. In other words, I don't want you to be limited by any factor other than your personal priorities. In this chapter, I will show you how to eliminate the injury barrier by adding cross-training to your 80-20 running program. 2 approaches to cross-training. I believe that most runners, including those who seldom get injured, should do at least 1 non-impact cardio workout per week when healthy. The reason is that runners who make cross-training a part of their normal routine are more prepared physically and psychologically to fall back on an alternative form of exercise in times of crisis. On the psychological side, runners who cross-train only when they are injured have a greater tendency to run when they shouldn't. Lacking a ready fallback option, they try to push through the pain instead of taking the cautious route and hitting the elliptical trainer, or whatever, instead. Runners who don't wait until they are hurt to cross-train tend to be more comfortable with the idea of replacing all of their runs with non-impact aerobic workouts when it's the wise thing to do. Often, runners who cross-train only when injured are also ill-prepared physically to transfer their training regimen from running to an alternative activity when necessary. It takes time for the musculoskeletal system to adapt to any form of exercise. If you immediately go from running every day to, say, cycling every day because of an injury, there's a good chance you'll also suffer a cycling-related overuse injury. If you've been riding a bike once a week all along, though, your body will be able to make the adjustment smoothly. If your only purpose in cross-training is to get your mind and body prepared to rely exclusively on cross-training to maintain fitness when you're injured, then it is enough to merely replace one of your weekly runs with a non-impact alternative. But my goal here is to encourage you to use cross-training for the additional purpose of increasing your overall training volume and enhancing your fitness. To fulfill this purpose, you must incorporate cross-training into your program in a manner that increases your overall training volume. There are two general approaches to doing this: minimalist and aggressive. One of the two will be right for you. The minimalist approach. The minimalist method entails adding a single cross-training session to your current running schedule. Suppose, for example, you are currently running 5 times per week. If you add one cross-training workout to your regimen, you'll increase your training volume by 20% without subjecting your legs to any additional impact stress. Trust me, you will get a noticeable boost from this investment, yet your injury risk will change only marginally. This is a good option for runners who don't want to add a lot of additional training time to their schedule, or who wish to dip their toes into cross-training before taking the full plunge. But it's also a good fit for durable, high-mileage runners who are already doing about as much running as their body can handle and wish to use cross-training to raise their fitness level one more notch without subjecting their legs to any additional pounding. Many elite runners do just one cross-training workout per week to supplement 100 miles or more of running. The aggressive approach. The aggressive approach to cross-training is also the cautious approach. It is aggressive in the sense that it entails including multiple cross-training workouts in the weekly training routine for the sake of increasing fitness. Yet at the same time, it is cautious in the sense that most runners who take this approach simultaneously reduce the amount of running they do to minimize injury risk and or general wear and tear on the legs. The typical aggressive cross trainer is a highly competitive runner who has been frustrated by repeated injuries. Most runners don't trust the benefits of cross training enough to give it a large and permanent place in their training routine until a series of breakdowns leaves them desperate and ready to try anything to break the cycle. Those who take a chance on the aggressive approach are often pleasantly surprised. Indeed, there are some noteworthy examples of top runners who have drastically reduced their running volume without any loss of performance because cross-training has successfully filled the gap. The poster boy of the aggressive approach to cross-training is Meb Keflezighi, who in 2009 became the first American to win the New York City Marathon since Alberto Salazar in 1982. Less durable than many of his rivals, Meb used various non-impact forms of cross-training throughout his career, both to stay fit when he was hurt and to supplement a reduced-mileage running regimen when he was healthy. In 2013, when he was 37 years old, Keflezighi was forced to withdraw from the Boston Marathon with a calf injury. While it healed, he spent a lot of time riding an outdoor elliptical bike and a regular bike. When the healing was complete, Meb shifted to a schedule of running once a day in the morning and doing a non-impact aerobic workout in the afternoon. Meb was still healthy and as fit as he'd ever been when the Boston Marathon came around again in April, 2 weeks shy of his 39th birthday. He won the race in a career-best time of 2 hours, 8 minutes, 37 seconds, defeating a strong elite field that included the world's two top-ranked marathoners from the previous year. The aggressive approach to cross-training is suitable not only for injury-prone runners of all ages, but also for any runner over the age of 35 who wishes to protect his or her legs from some of the cumulative effects of many years of high-mileage running. It is an unfortunate reality that runners slow down with age at a steeper rate than other endurance athletes do. Scientists don't know exactly why this is the case, but experienced older runners often report feeling as though years of high-mileage training has taken some of the bounce out of their legs. This is a scientifically plausible explanation because running performance depends on a certain kind of bounciness, whereas performance in other non-impact endurance disciplines does not. In cycling and swimming, the best athletes over the age of 40 are typically the same men and women who were the best in their sport when they were in their early 20s. Running is different. Most of the Masters world records in running are held by runners who started late. Catherine Martin, for example, took up running at age 30 and subsequently rewrote the U.S. record book in the 50 to 54 and 55 to 59 age groups. Martin's male counterpart, Ed Whitlock, did some running as a schoolboy, but only got serious in middle age. When he was 73 years old, Whitlock ran a marathon in 2 hours, 54 minutes, 48 seconds. Runners who are the best in the world in their 20s and who keep competing past middle age are almost never the top competitors in the older age groups. Most are still very good, of course, but they slow down precipitously after age 45 and are eclipsed by late starters like Martin and Whitlock. Bill Rogers was one of the fastest marathon runners in the world in his prime, but between his 50th and 60th birthdays, his 10K time slowed by a staggering 10 minutes. By the end of that slide, Rogers was no longer among the fastest runners his age in America. There is limited evidence that prolonged high-mileage running accelerates muscle aging in a way that might explain why many older runners feel that years of pounding the pavement have made their stride less bouncy. In 2010, Dale Ray and colleagues at the University of Cape Town measured the length of DNA strands extracted from the calf muscles of a group of experienced middle-aged runners. Scientists measured the length of DNA strands inside the cells to assess physiological age. Time and stress cause our DNA to progressively shorten. Ray's team discovered a significant inverse correlation between running experience and habitual training volume on the one hand, and DNA length on the other. In other words, within this group of experienced middle-aged runners, those who had the fewest miles in their legs had the youngest DNA. It's important not to overinterpret this finding, however. When Ray and his colleagues compared the average length of muscle cell DNA in middle-aged runners to that of age-matched non-runners, they found no difference. So there's no need for runners in their 20s to panic and run less than they would otherwise. But I do think it's sensible for experienced runners to transition to doing more cross-training and less running after age 35. Those who do so stand to extend their peak performance years and ultimately reduce the rate at which their performance declines. There are many ways to balance running and cross-training within the aggressive approach. The more concerned you are with maximizing performance, the more cross-training workouts you should do. The more concerned you are with reducing injury risk or wear and tear on your legs, the fewer runs you should do. 3 runs per week should be considered a minimum. It's hard to make any progress as a runner if you run less than every other day or so, no matter how much you cross-train. A sensible upper limit for total workouts in a week, running plus cross-training, is 13. That's 2 workouts per day on 6 days of the week, plus 1 workout on a designated recovery day. Of these 13 workouts, no more than 6 or 7 need to be runs, even if you're 100% committed to becoming the best runner you can be. If Meb Keflezighi can run a 2-hour, 8-minute marathon on 7 runs per week, plus an equal number of cross-training sessions, then surely you can achieve your goals with a similar regimen. I recommend that you increase the total number of workouts in your typical training week by no more than 1 or 2 sessions at a time. Abrupt increases in overall training volume are likely to cause burnout, even if the additional workouts are non-impact and don't increase injury risk. Let's say you're currently running 6 times per week. From here, you might switch to a schedule of 6 runs and 1 cross-training workout, or 5 runs and 2 cross-training workouts. If your body tolerates the increased training load well, you may then move to a schedule of 8 or 9 total workouts per week. Table 12.1 in the bonus PDF presents a full range of different ways to balance running and cross-training with either the aggressive approach or the minimalist, and provides information about the type of runner that is the best match for each specific option. You may need to experiment a bit to find the balance that's best for you. Be aware, too, that the ideal balance may change over time. When in doubt about what to do, err on the side of more cross-training, because more volume equals more fitness, and less running, because less running means less injury risk. Regardless of how you choose to balance running and cross-training, it's essential that you apply the 80-20 rule to your total training regimen, not just your running. If you run 4 hours per week and cycle 2 hours per week, for example, the total amount of moderate and high-intensity training you do each week should be about 72 minutes or 20% of 6 hours. It is not necessary, however, to follow the 80-20 rule in running and cross-training individually. On the contrary, I believe it's best to do your hardest work in the discipline you're actually preparing to compete in. Therefore, I advise you to do all of your cross-training workouts at low intensity and concentrate your full allotment of moderate and high-intensity training within your runs. So again, if you run 4 hours per week and cycle 2 hours, I suggest you do 72 minutes of running per week at moderate and high intensity, and the full 2 hours you spend on the bike at low intensity. Exempt yourself from this advice, however, if you are prone to suffering injuries such as Achilles tendon strains and hamstring strains that are associated with faster running. In this case, concentrate your full allotment of moderate and high intensity training within your chosen cross-training discipline. If you're already injured and currently unable to run, your best course of action is to replace each planned run on your schedule with a cross-training version of the same workout. So for example, if you were supposed to do a dozen 60-second hill repetitions in Zone 5 on a given day, but you can't because your knee hurts, do a similar session on your bike instead. You can use the same tools to monitor and control intensity in cross-training workouts as you do in your runs. Note, however, that heart rate zones differ slightly from one activity to the next. The lactate threshold heart rate is generally about 10 beats per minute higher in running than it is in most non-impact alternatives. So if you use a heart rate monitor to regulate intensity in cross-training workouts, you'll first need to do a 30-minute time trial, perceived effort test, or talk test in that activity and use the results to calculate zones that are specific to it. The 7 best cross-training activities for runners. There are many forms of non-impact aerobic exercise. Some are better than others for runners. As you might expect, those that are most similar to running have the greatest fitness carryover to running. Activities that involve alternating movements of the legs, such as cycling, work very well. Upper body dominant activities, such as swimming, do not. Support for the specificity principle in cross-training comes from a clever study conducted by French researchers in 2002. A group of elite triathletes was monitored for 40 weeks. Training volume was tracked separately in each discipline. Every few weeks, the subjects completed performance tests in the pool, on the bike, and on the treadmill. When all of the data had been collected, the researchers compared the volume of training in each discipline against performance in all 3 disciplines. These cross-correlations allowed the researchers to estimate the effect of, say, swim training, not just on swimming performance, but also on cycling and running performance. Not surprisingly, the researchers found that bike training had a strong positive effect on running performance, but swimming did not. Cycling is not the only effective form of cross-training for runners, however. There are 7 forms of non-impact aerobic exercise, including cycling, that stand out from the rest. Each has advantages and disadvantages relative to the others, but you can't go wrong with any of them. Consider factors such as your personal likes and dislikes, convenience, and budget when deciding which activity is right for you. If, for example, you live in an urban area where cycling is a hassle, but you happen to own a treadmill, then uphill treadmill walking might be your best option. In Table 8.2, found in the bonus PDF, I grade each cross-training activity on the 3 key factors of running specificity, convenience, and enjoyableness. It's okay to do more than one form of cross-training. I myself ride an elliptical bike and a regular bike, and I do some uphill treadmill walking as well, because I enjoy all 3 activities and I enjoy cross-training more in general when my routine is varied. Anti-gravity treadmill running. Technically, anti-gravity treadmill running is not an alternative to running. It's an alternative form of running. The machine that it's done on consists of a normal treadmill with a tent-like enclosure attached to it. The user steps through a hole at the top of the enclosure and zips himself or herself in around the waist, creating an airtight seal. The chamber is then pressurized, and this high-pressure zone gently lifts the runner, effectively reducing the force of gravity within it. The amount of pressure is adjustable, enabling the user to run at anywhere between 20% and 100% of his or her actual body weight. The lower the user goes within this range, the less pounding the body is subjected to. The intensity of the workout also decreases with effective body weight, so it's necessary to run faster than normal to get an equivalent workout on an anti-gravity treadmill. Runners who use these machines for supplemental training usually run at an effective body weight of 90 to 95%, but most are professionals who are very light to begin with. Settings in the range of 80 to 85% of full body weight are preferable for heavier and less durable recreational runners. You might as well err on the low side because you can always adjust your speed to get your heart rate up to where it would normally be for the type of workout you're doing. One study found that by running faster on an anti-gravity treadmill, runners were able to get their maximum rate of oxygen consumption just as high at 85% of their body weight as they were at their full body weight. The chief advantage of anti-gravity treadmill running is that it is more like normal running than any other form of cross-training. Therefore, it probably enhances running performance more effectively than the other options do. I say probably because this conjecture has not been formally tested. Anti-gravity treadmills also have an advantage for injured runners. Because running on an anti-gravity treadmill is a low-impact activity instead of a non-impact activity, it does a better job of helping injured runners maintain their adaptations to repetitive impact, such as increased bone density, during prolonged periods of rehabilitation. This leaves them less likely to develop a new injury when they return to normal running. It is possible to train through almost any injury on an anti-gravity treadmill. All you have to do is keep reducing the effective body weight setting until you're able to run pain-free. As you heal, you can gradually increase your effective body weight, always using pain as your guide until you are able to run normally again. The major disadvantages of anti-gravity treadmills are cost and accessibility. Currently, there is only one manufacturer, the technology's inventor, AlterG. The cheaper of the 2 models that the company offers goes for $25,000, which is more than most runners are willing or able to spend. Some physical therapy clinics and fitness facilities rent out time on anti-gravity treadmills, but even if there is such a facility close to your home, this is not the most convenient or affordable way to cross-train. Another disadvantage of anti-gravity treadmill running is that it's rather boring. I once spent several hours over a 2-day period running on an Alter G that was set up at a trade show booth belonging to a company I was affiliated with. Those hours felt like days. Bicycling. Cycling is not nearly as running specific as anti-gravity treadmill running. Whereas cycling is a seated activity, running is upright. On the bike, the quadriceps act as prime movers, but in running, they are used primarily as shock absorbers. Despite such differences, there is abundant scientific and real-world evidence that cycling fitness transfers well to running. There are two ways to ride a bike: outdoors on roads or trails, and indoors on a stationary machine. Outdoor riding is generally regarded as being more enjoyable, while indoor riding is more convenient, especially in foul weather. It's also less intimidating for the technically inept runner, like me, who takes 20 minutes to fix a flat tire. If you intend to do a lot of cycling, it's important that you use a bike that fits you properly. A proper bike fit is much more complex than a proper running shoe fit. Getting the right size is only the beginning. On top of this, you need to make sure your saddle height, saddle fore aft position, crank arm length, handlebar position, and several other settings are dialed in just right. This requires that you get a professional fitting from a certified bike fitter. Putting in a lot of miles with the seat just a centimeter too high or too low, or with some other setting just slightly off, is likely to result in knee pain, lower back pain, or other common cycling overuse injuries. Outdoor elliptical biking. An elliptical bike is like the elliptical trainers you see at every gym, except that it has two wheels and is ridden outdoors. The machine was invented by a Southern California outfit called Elliptic Go. The company's founders happened to be friends of mine, and I was an early adopter of the technology. Call me biased, but if I had to name one cross-training activity for runners as the best overall, outdoor elliptical biking would be my choice. The standard indoor elliptical trainer was invented specifically to simulate the running action without impact, so there's no question that fitness earned on the outdoor version transfers well to running. The big advantage of outdoor elliptical biking is that it's really fun. After 20 minutes on an indoor elliptical trainer, I'm about ready to scream, but I routinely take my Elliptic Go for 2- and 3-hour rides and enjoy every minute. Fun matters. The more you enjoy a cross-training activity, the more time you'll be willing to put into it, and the more fitness you'll get out of it. Within the past several years, outdoor elliptical biking has become quite trendy among professional runners in the United States. In addition to Adriana Nelson Purdy and Meb Keflezighi, who I've mentioned already, 2012 Olympian Julie Cully, 2-time USA outdoor 5,000-meter champion Lauren Fleshman, 2000 Olympian Adam Goucher, 5,000-meter American record holder Molly Huddle, 5-time USA outdoor 800-meter champion Alicia Montaño, and 2-hour 29-minute marathoner Stephanie Rothstein have all been spotted zooming around on Elliptic Go bikes. Outdoor elliptical training has two potential drawbacks. One is cost. Elliptic Go bikes are made with racing-quality materials and parts, so they aren't cheap. $2,200 and up. There are cheaper elliptical bikes on the market, but they are not suitable for serious cross-training. The other potential downside of outdoor elliptical biking is that it is not a practicable option in all environments and weather conditions. If you live in an area with very narrow road shoulders or long icy winters, outdoor elliptical biking is not the best cross-training option for you. Indoor elliptical training. The standard indoor elliptical trainer has become something of a red-headed stepchild since the advent of the outdoor elliptical bike, but it's still a great form of running-specific cross-training. Convenience is a major plus of the activity. As an indoor pursuit, elliptical training can be done anytime. And if you have a gym membership, you have ready access to high-quality elliptical trainers. The only drawback of indoor elliptical training is the boredom factor. Pool running. Pool running, which entails simulating a normal running action while running in deep water, used to be the go-to cross-training activity for injured elite runners. It has since lost popularity to newer alternatives such as anti-gravity treadmill running and outdoor elliptical biking. But some elite runners still use pool running for cooldowns after long runs to pad their training volume without increasing injury risk. The main advantage of pool running is that when done correctly, it very closely simulates the action of overground running. For this reason, fitness developed through pool running transfers well to normal running. One study found that runners were able to fully maintain their fitness level with 6 weeks of exclusive pool running. When running in water, you should make your best effort to mimic a natural overground running stride as closely as possible. This is next to impossible if you're not wearing a pool running vest, such as those made by Aquajogger, which do the work of keeping you afloat so you can concentrate on using your arms and legs to simulate normal running. These products cost $40 to $60 and are available at many running specialty stores. The big difference between overground running and pool running is that the former is a closed-chain activity, meaning there is contact with the ground, whereas pool running is an open-chain activity with no weight-bearing whatsoever. If you do nothing but pool running for exercise during a period of injury, therefore, you will lose bone density in your legs as well as other adaptations to repetitive impact, and as a result, you will be at greater risk of suffering a new injury when you return to normal running. So it's best to mix pool running with a weight-bearing activity such as elliptical training during extended periods of injury rehabilitation. If you have an injury such as a stress fracture that prevents you from doing any form of weight-bearing activity, however, then pool running could be a lifesaver. As a supplement to running itself, pool running rates lower than other options on the fun scale. Indeed, I rate it as the dullest form of cross-training I've ever tried, and I've tried them all. Nor have I ever met a runner who says he or she loves the activity. Slide boarding. Few runners have ever heard of slide boarding. A slide board is a long rectangular plastic surface upon which the user slides from side to side between bumpers positioned at either end while wearing special fabric booties, thus simulating a skating motion. Slide boarding is typically done by hockey players and speed skaters when they can't get on the ice to train. Slide boarding offers a number of advantages as a cross-training activity for runners. It provides an excellent aerobic training stimulus through a weight-bearing action involving alternating use of the legs, just like running. It is also convenient. A slide board contains no moving or metal parts and can be laid out anywhere in your home and rolled up for storage when you're done, and you can even travel with one. Slide boards are also far less expensive than other home exercise products. I got mine for $249. What's more, I find slide boarding much more fun than other indoor aerobic activities, almost as enjoyable as actual ice skating. The big difference between slide boarding and running is that running is a forward movement, whereas slide boarding is a lateral movement. But even this difference counts as a positive. Slide boarding strengthens the muscles on the inside and outside of the hips that tend to be weak in runners and whose weakness often contributes to knee injuries. Despite its lack of familiarity, slide boarding is a great cross-training choice for runners who prize convenience and affordability and are susceptible to knee pain. Uphill treadmill walking. Walking was the original form of cross-training for runners. Until the 1940s, most competitive distance runners did some walking as part of their training. The practice died out, though, after Arthur Lydiard decided that slow running was more beneficial than walking. When cross-training made a comeback in the 1990s, walking was overlooked in favor of other activities such as elliptical training that seemed to better match the intensity of running. But there is a particular form of walking that does not suffer from this drawback: uphill treadmill walking. Uphill treadmill walking is better than regular walking in two ways. First, while it's hard to get the heart rate up into the zone 2 range on an outdoor walk in most environments, with uphill treadmill walking it's easy. Second, uphill treadmill walking is more similar to running on a neuromuscular level. Research has shown that when a person is moving up a steep incline at the precise speed at which he or she feels the urge to transition from a walking gait to a running gait, the brain uses the same motor pattern to produce either movement. In other words, the distinction between walking and running effectively disappears. If you're skeptical, try this experiment. Hop on a treadmill, set the belt at a 15% incline, and start walking slowly. Next, increase your speed in small increments until you feel an urge to transition to running. At this point, go ahead and start running. After a few moments, go back to walking. You will notice that your movements are not actually changing. Even when you tell yourself you're running, you always have one foot in contact with the ground, as in walking. For most runners, the speed at which this walk-run convergence occurs falls within the moderate intensity or even the high intensity range, so it's too fast for cross-training workouts. But even slow walking on a steep incline is more running specific than most other forms of cross-training. I do it at least a couple of times every week, and the fitness transfer to running is palpable. When you first try uphill treadmill walking, you will have to play around with the different speeds and gradients to find those that place you in zones 1 and 2. Be sure to keep your first few sessions relatively short to avoid straining your calf muscles and Achilles tendons. After a couple of weeks, these tissues will be fully adapted to the activity. Uphill treadmill walking has the potential to be boring, but it's seldom boring for me because I read while I'm doing it. I get through a book a week this way. There's nothing like giving your brain and your body a workout at the same time. Your cross-training routine. When you design your next training plan, consider slightly increasing the average amount of training you do compared to your past routine. Decide how many total workouts per week you'll need to do to affect this increase, and how many of these workouts will be cross-training sessions. Also, settle on one or more specific non-running activities you'll rely on for supplemental aerobic training. Plan to maintain a consistent schedule of cross-training and running workouts from week to week throughout the training process, so that your body can get used to it. The training plans presented in chapters 8 through 11 were designed to facilitate this approach. First of all, they prescribe higher volume than most training plans intended for mass consumption. They also have built-in flexibility in terms of how much of the prescribed training takes the form of running. Choose the days on which you will exercise the option to cross-train before you begin to execute any of these plans. Remember, however, to treat your plan as just that, a plan. If you're ever too sore to run on a given day when you have a run planned, make a spontaneous switch to cross-training. Likewise, if you develop a running-related injury, replace all of your planned runs with low-impact or non-impact alternatives. Because you will have been cross-training all along, this adjustment, should it be required, won't be difficult for you, either physically or psychologically.